copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Why is it that we have good answers but so few are listening? So I think this is really going to be an extension of the discussion that we have just had. So I try to begin each one with a quote from Schaeffer to, as we say, get us into the ballpark. Schaeffer says, despite claims of cultural relevance and accommodating evangelism, also leaves the destructive surrounding culture increasingly unchallenged. Now, I would say to all of my evangelical brothers and sisters, I think that what we are doing is born out of a very good intention. I do not judge motives. I think they are, as we say, stellar. The idea that you want to reach as many people for Christ, that is a good thing, all right? So I don't think it's a matter of motive. I think we have not been as critical of ourselves as we ought to be when it comes to trying to determine what we should do in our evangelism. So consider, as I say, the state of the world in general. I'm now using the world there in terms of not the globe, but as John uses the word, you know, the ideas, the worldviews of our culture. That naturalism is the general perception of reality. So we can come back to your comment about are we practical atheists. Sometimes I think we're practical naturalists as well. Schaeffer said, he says he was, they were walking in the mountains, the Swiss Alps one day. I think this is a context. But anyway, his wife Edith was with him, and he said to her, I wonder, Edith, what would happen if tomorrow morning the church woke up and found out that the Holy Spirit had been removed? And he said, I don't think it would make a big difference. And I'm sorry, but I think he's probably right that we have not seen the role of the Holy Spirit, which is another lecture, which we won't do here. But we are living in this where naturalism is a perception of reality. We have terribly disordering values. Is it the discussion that we had just before we started this section, right? The disordering of values. And I would then say there's a replacement. Now, I'm just making a statement at this point. I'm not making an argument, of course. But values have replaced virtues. And the church has seen that is to be insignificant. I would argue it is terribly significant. Think for a moment. Somebody says, oh, I think we need to return to family values. That's language we hear most of the time. And I'm saying, oh, yeah, that's really great. Family values depend on what you think a family is. Family values are relative. Virtues are not. Read the medievals. They talk about virtues, not values. Now, where did we get this notion of values? We didn't get it from reading the Bible. You say, don't be so nitpicky. It's only a word. Oh, we're right. It's only a word with significance. Because values and virtues are not signaling the same thing. And because this has happened, everything in our society needs to begin with a calculation with a great economic calculator. Now, it's not just, let me first say, it's not just in the church. I will not get political at this point, though I have it points. Notice what has happened in the recent discussion of what happened in Crimea. I'm not getting into the right, the wrong, all that. I have my own opinions there. But notice that when we decided, or the larger community decided, what will we do to what was perceived as Russian aggression? And when they thought about putting economic sanctions, immediately there were some countries that said, no, we can't do that because it will hurt our economy. Everything today is calculated by the great economic calculator. Now, do economics matter? Well, enormously, of course. But as Christians, they cannot be the final criteria by which we determine what we are going to do and what we are not going to do. And yet, it so often does seem to be the case. The implausibility of God, I have already spoken about that, how pluralism has leveled much of the culture, resulting in one belief not being any more important than other beliefs. So remember, I'm thinking, why is it that we have good answers, but nobody's listening? Because they don't see that our beliefs are any better than their beliefs. Because their general thought about beliefs is that one doesn't exist above another. There is this leveling effect that has, as I've indicated, that then the sacred is abandoned. And I would think that we even see some of that in evangelicalism. And there seems to be nothing that stands above something else worth our sacrifice. If all ideas are equal, why sacrifice for your idea? And if you're not willing to sacrifice for your idea, then you don't have a great interest or investment in your idea. We have done what we can do, I think, in many cases, in evangelicalism, is to make us look as acceptable to the world as we possibly can. We don't want people coming to our services feeling uncomfortable. And I don't suggest that we do things intentionally to make people feel uncomfortable. But the fact of the matter is, our message is. We think about, am I willing as a parent to believe that that social media, let's just say, certain aspects of it, that I'm not going to purchase an iPad for my 3-year-old. Okay? I'm not going to do that. Well, yeah, but when they go to kindergarten, the other 3-year-olds, they do have one. Isn't your 3-year-old going to feel rather put up? That's just part, folks, of us reordering our lives. And that's calling for the sacrifice, to be somewhat different. I remember I was in a Eastern European country, and I was invited to go to this particular church. And as the preacher, he was a good preacher, young man, and I thought to myself, he's a really young man, I'd like to know something about him. And I was told that his dad was a pastor under communism and was often taken in interrogation, wasn't home, in the jail, etc. And I'm thinking to myself, why in the world would a young person who grew up with a dad he spent much of his time in prison and be, why in the world would he want to be a preacher? And then it dawned on me. Because it showed that young person that the beliefs of Christianity were really worth even dying for. If we don't have that notion, I think that's one reason that the world is not listening to us. Because they don't see that sense in us. It's no sacrifice for you to tumble out of bed at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning and grab your Bible and go to church. In fact, the world doesn't even care that you do that. But it is quite a thing for you to stand up, to order your life, your family life, your church life, in a way that reflects that you live according to a different standard, that you see that certain things are not neutral. They are, in fact. They carry with them something. So when you and I speak of our beliefs, there's no reason for anybody or for culture to think that our beliefs are superior to other beliefs, and we can make good arguments, right, that God is there. But if there is no existential, by that there is no change that comes into our lives because of this, then the world has a right to ask, so what makes your belief superior to mine? Freedom today is becoming absolute. Choices for the sake of choices. We're free because we have so many choices. And I don't quote Zengati Ta, who has written a book, Mediated Reality. He's not a Christian, but it's a very eye-opening book on this very subject. We feel that we've got to give everybody choices, right? Our children have got a multiplicity of choices. What do you want to do? You want to be in this sports, that sports, this sports, you know, all of these. So we've got the family who's terribly busy today, but because we've bought into the cultural notion, you've got to have a lot of choices because that's how we demonstrate our freedom. Now, the state of the church, I think, is where we need to do focus. And I would say there was a sense of loss of community. I think there are some churches that are honestly seeking to bring that back. It's interesting to me that we're doing it by program, when it seems to me it should be the normal outflow of teaching of the Bible. So I guess I should be happy that at least it's being done, even if it's done by program. But it tends to be so artificial when it's done that way. We have bought into the acceptance of convenience and efficiency. So, this is what we can do. We can have my home church. You know, I don't really like having to drive in the traffic and all on Sunday morning. So why don't you just beam the message into a building in my church, in my city or in my part of the city. And that way I could just go down there and I can come in with my coffee and I can come in with my sandals and maybe my pajamas if I want to, because after all, it doesn't really much matter. And this is just church and, it's really nothing. And I need to be comfortable when I get there. And so I don't need to have to dress up. It doesn't have to be any real big issue. And I'm saying, so what have we lost? What do we lose? Well, information is the same. There's no doubt about that. But as I've said earlier, the people who sit in front of face-to-face teaching are not getting precisely the same thing as those who are watching it. Now, on a flat screen, you say, well, aren't you kind of defeating your purpose that you're having this recorded? And I say, well, there's a place for it. Don't misunderstand me. But I'm wondering if we're not trying to substitute too much because we think there is nothing lost in the doing of it. But it is efficient and it's convenient. There's no doubt about that. The uncritical use of social media. I know some churches that are now counseling by Facebook. Does that just strike us as being strange? But it's efficient and it is convenient. So why would we think that people would want to be sacrificed to reorder their lives? I note here that studies reveal that young people claim that they leave the church after attending university because of the conflict between faith and science. But I think that reveals a more serious and a systemic problem, namely that they don't understand properly either. Now, the nature of our message, and this is where I come to this idea that we buy into progress through the back door. that is efficiency and convenience. But with it comes the notion that new is always preferred to the old. Now the problem that creates for us is that what you and I have is a historic message, grounded in history. And so we take this historic message and we're proclaiming it, but we're proclaiming it in a community that is revealing an ethos of consumerism. Which one is going to have the strongest influence? I will argue the ethos of consumerism will. If you go to the mall as you come under the spell of consumerism and you're with another person and you decide, oh boy, I just saw this, you know, I need to have this. I didn't think you needed it before you got there, but now you need it. And somebody says to you, but you know, that's probably not a good idea. But once you have been affected by the ethos of consumerism, I bet you'll still buy it, even though you may know that it won't be a very good choice. That's the power of the ethos of consumerism. So even if you are given the right message, if we aren't creating an ethos in the church with the ethos of the kingdom, we keep having this conflict. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's difficult for people to listen to our message. I say that the method and the message, we say that we're saying the same thing, but our methods have changed, and I think that reflects a misunderstanding. We've spoken to the matter of dividing our world into the sacred and the secular, and has been to say that everything is sacred. I think what we've overdone is that we've overstated our case. In fact, what's happened is everything's become secular. Because we didn't understand what Schaeffer was talking about when he said there's no distinction between the sacred and the secular. Now everything actually has become secular. It doesn't matter. Now, I'm probably a little bit on the edge on this, okay? So I'll admit that. I'm an old man, and I lived at a different time. Came into existence personally just shortly after the Earth's crust turned hard. I've got some baggage. I don't deny it. But does your costume, your clothes, does it say anything? I would say, yeah, it does. Students will argue me and say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't really much matter. I say, oh, it doesn't, okay. I said, suppose tomorrow morning I come to class to teach metaphysics, but I'm going to come in a pink tutu with a bow in my hair. How shall that go? Well, you can't. Well, I said, what the difference does it make? Well, it would be saying something about you. I thought you just told me that it doesn't say anything, that costumes don't say anything about the person or the event. Well, in fact, it really does. I think we've been kind of blind to all those things. I don't mean that everybody's got to come to church in a tuxedo or anything like that. And I don't even think people have to come coming coat and tie. But I do think that if we think that we are coming together with something really special, something unique, there ought to be something about the way we present ourselves when we come together with the church that it says, yeah, I think this is special. I think that this is unique. That there's a great debate on that, but because I'm teaching, I can say it, and you can think, yeah, the guy's crazy, and that's okay. Just please don't broadcast it. The heart of Christ, the mind of the world, I think that they're two in opposition. There's antithesis that Schaeffer and Kuyper both spoke of. I think that's melting in our world. That the church, the world doesn't see a real sharp distinction. They hear our message. That's a distinction. But it's broadcast, it's proclaimed in an environment that has the same ethos as the world in which they live. So that now the person in the church looks more like a consumer than a worshiper. that the gospel looks more like a product than it is a message of how one has relationship with God. We talk about, you know, our market share as Christians. These are B people, these are A people. I know what we're doing, but I'm just wondering if we're not being unwise in some of that. We tell young people, you must change the world. What a hideous notion. What young person or group of young persons could possibly bear the burden of changing the world? Now, what you can do is make a difference. The first order of our lives is not to change the world. It's to be faithful to Christ. And I think even though we have the right answers, those right answers have not been translated into everyday living as they might be. And as a consequence, the world continues to think that our beliefs are really no better than their beliefs. And hence, why bother to listen to us? The last word I would say is this. I think that people intuitively move towards that which demands sacrifice and commitment. I really do. I think we're wrong-headed psychologically thinking, well, you just come to Jesus. You know, it's not going to require much of you. I think that's wrong-headed. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones said that a long time ago, and much better than I. But I do think we need to think about that. Do we want to make it as easy as possible? I don't mean we put things in the way, necessarily, but that it seems to me Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. We need to know at what point is it that we need to demonstrate that our beliefs do make a difference and then be willing to live out those beliefs before a watching world. And I do think it will create or cause sacrifice. Okay. Questions or comments? Yes. Thank you. You're a good congregant. Good. what examples do I see where the sacred is taken out? Now I'm going to say a tautology. the sacred is now absent. That is, nothing is considered to be, in the general thinking of the world, nothing is, gosh, I use the word sacred, nothing is a marked-off event or a marked-off place that has uniqueness and has a special relationship to humanity. Okay, I'll give you an example where it still exists, but and I'll show you how this relates to the transcendent. I suspect none of you have been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington, D.C. You have, okay. If you have been there, when the military put the wreath, that's done, I think, once a day, is put up there, you cannot sit. You cannot talk. It is absolutely, you are just to stand there, as it were, in awe of what's being happening. Why? Well, it's sacred. But then you have to ask yourself, why is it sacred? Is it sacred because some god came down and touched it? No, it is sacred because underneath what that represents a transcendent principle. That makes it sacred. Not sacred in the religious sense, as we often think, but just sacred as a marked off. This is something that has special significance. It's elevated above the everyday activity. You can walk all around Washington, D.C. You can go to the different places. But when you come to the tomb of the unknown soldier, now this is a special place. I'm not going to say it's like, you know, Moses, take off your sandals for where you're standing is holy ground. But that is what illustrates the principle of which I'm talking about. So are there some things in the Christian life that we think are sacred? That is, that are marked off, that they don't, that they're not talked about, they're not engaged in the common or what we call the vulgar way? And I would say, yes, there really is. I think that when the Church of Christ comes together, that there's something special going on. Now, maybe the Catholic Church, you think they've gone too far with that in their sacramental theology. Well, if they've gone too far in one direction, evangelicals, I think, have gone too far in another direction. What is the Lord's table to most of us? The communion, the Eucharist, what is it to most of us? In many churches, it looks very little different. There's a very little difference between the Lord's table and taking up the offering. The only difference is that in the latter, you put something in the plate. In the former, you take something out, right? But it's done in almost the same offhanded fashion. Now you say, "Well, you mean that there's some kind of grace conferred?" I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if in 1 Corinthians 11 we find that God judges the church at Corinth for its the offhanded manner in which it partook and participated in the Lord's table, then it seems to me it must be kind of important. Some of them, he says, even had died. So that would be an area within the church where I think, you know, what do we need to do here? You know, we become so, you know, as I said, when they said everything is under the sacred, but what's ended up happening, everything has become secular. Everything's become leveled. Is the preaching of the word sacred? What was the pulpit called at one point? The sacred desk. Today, now I know that, as I said, I always have to keep apologizing because, you know, sometimes I speak this way and it seems like it's so far in another direction that you wonder if I live on the same planet as you do. But today, churches don't have pulpits anymore. They have plexiglass lecterns. You say, what does it matter? Well, I'm going to argue it matters a lot. But it only matters to those who had the notion that the preaching of the word was a sacred task. Do you know what the collar that some religious denominations use? Do you know what the collar represents? Exactly, it represented the slave yoke. Absolutely, is that how we think about pastors today? That they are these great servants of God, and they are under His control. You think, but that doesn't really matter. And on the one hand, I understand what you're saying, but as you remove the symbols out of your culture, you're losing the sacred symbols that the church has held to. Now, then they're all being replaced with something else. Okay? So you would all know if I have a picture of an apple with a bite taken out of it, that's a symbol you know about, right? You know the Nike symbol and all the... So you can identify, right? You can identify just that by looking at the symbol. We as Christians have seemed to think that symbols are not important. But maybe they are important. Symbols often mark off the sacred. So maybe if I'm way over here, some people will hear it and come maybe over here. Oh, yeah, okay, well, maybe. Does that sound crazy? I mean, you can say it does if you want to. It's not right. Yeah.
The other thing that I've...
You mean, so I think I know what you're saying, but are you saying that then that the symbols just become another thing we do and they lose their meaning? Always the danger. There's always a danger of where the good thing becomes the negative thing. But I would argue that's a problem with the heart. Is it possible that, let's just say, is it possible that, this is really crazy, but I'm going to say, if you're going to come to my church, you're going to have to wear a gown, and everybody else is going to have to wear, a tux. And is it possible that that begins with people having a sense of reverence because of the way they're dressed? Oh, absolutely. But is it also possible that within a short period of time, that simply becomes a very legalistic thing and people dress up in order to be something? So no matter how we move with these matters, it always takes a lot of energy to keep things from getting off course. So I think you're right. On all of these things, we run that danger. And the other thing would be, we shouldn't make any of these things a matter of spirituality. I think that would be a terrible thing to do. You know, that he who comes or she who comes well-dressed is more spiritual than somebody that doesn't. And that, by the way, has been a problem. It really. So I have another little saying. It's easy to criticize the present if all you see are the errors of the past. So it's easy for us to criticize what was in the past if all we ever see is what was wrong with the past. But there are some good things. So what we learn from the present and from young people and others who kind of push back on all of this, and I would stand up with them and stand in their corner. But I'm saying the push back on this doesn't mean a total contrary position. It means looking at that particular situation and ask ourselves the question, why is it that this seemingly good thing degenerated into this? So would it be simply we get rid of that and, oh, now we've solved the problem? And I say, no, you haven't. You've just put something else in its place, which will do the same, become the very same thing a little bit later. It's what Schaefer called the blue jean mentality. He said, you know, I'm gonna do blue jeans at church because I'm different than everybody else. But before long, what's happening? Everybody's wearing blue jeans. So, you know, it's that sort of thing. So I really do have great empathy with it, precisely what you're talking about, and struggle to see where does the balance come in all of this. And I use some of the language or some of my illustrations, not necessarily because they're such great illustrations, but I'm trying to give people a flavor of what I'm talking about. And then we've got to stand back and say, how do we best remedy what's going on here? How is it that we can salvage what is good out of it and then be vigilant to make sure it doesn't stray off the path and become something we didn't want? Because that's where we see a big shift, right? Most churches, we see a very big shift there. We see a big shift in the music. Music is probably a little more controversial than clothes. But I do think clothes do matter. I think it's what we call costume. It's so hard to say, oh, well, clothes don't make a man, that's for sure, or a woman. I'm sure of that. How do we manage to say, I'm going to do this because it's something special? If we were going to go see the president, would we dress up? Yeah, we probably would. If we go see the prime minister, if we got a chance, would we dress up? Yeah. Are there events that we are invited to in the world that we go, and when we go to them, we dress up? Yeah, we do. And why? Because we do think there's something, whether it's clothes that show respect or whatever.
In my church, it's a very ordinary church, mm-hmm. lots of control to low-income people. And we try to emphasize those of us who are preaching or translating and leading the worship not to have clothes that draw too much attention to us.
Yes.
Because, for example, I translate some sermons from a pulpit, and we have a clear emphasis at the translation team that don't dress in such a way to draw attention away from the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, I think that, you know, there's a good point to be made there, that we should dress in a fashion that doesn't draw attention to ourselves. That could be both ways. That could be showing up in cutoffs, you know, or in a nice three-piece suit. You're right. So I would argue the exact same thing when people lead music, that it should be done in such a fashion that it doesn't draw attention to them as maybe appearing to be entertainers. So, yes, there are some really good principles that can be put in place that I think could inform us on how we might go about looking at these questions without becoming too much in either direction, to either extreme. Yeah, I think you're right that the sacred isn't coming out of the symbol. It's kind of a shorthand for the meaning of the symbol. You're right. If God isn't behind it, the symbol becomes absolutely nothing. And I think that in the balance of all of this is that what we need to do as church leaders is to do what can be done to give the notion, I'm going to even call it the ethos that what is going on here is special because it involves, if I may use the word, mystery. As we are now, the divine is somehow the finite is somehow participating in the divine as we come together through the preaching of the word, through the Lord's table, through giving. So it is certainly not all bearing over here on symbols, whether it be clothes or otherwise, but it's what are we seeking to do? Are we seeking to create in this sacred space, if I can say that, what are we seeking to do that fosters, that encourages this sense that I am here, but so are all these others, and that somehow in this gathering, all the eyes are participating in something very special. I don't think you do that by just simply putting on good clothes. I want to make that very clear. That's not done by... It's a whole issue that has to be put together, I think, that makes for a case that when we are gathered, that we sense this is something special. I don't mean that any kind of grace is dispensed or anything like that. What I do think is we shouldn't take our meetings together. If two or three are gathered together, He is in the midst of them. If the God, the Holy Spirit, lives within us, is there a sense in which, when we come together as believers, for the preaching of the word and for and else is in of the singing and all the rest of it, does that mean? That is a unique opportunity for us as a body to come together. And what should we do as church leaders, in a sense, to set that apart, make it say something about what we're doing there? Well, that's a I really do that not to lay down to pontificate. I only say these things to get us to think about. So anything I've said is not pontificating. I say some things to agitate people. Not intentionally, but it seems to. Not here necessarily. But really what I want to do is I want to encourage conversation and for us to think about what have we done? What are we doing? Are we doing the best? Have we misstepped somewhere? How do we make out, how do we really do our very best we can to make who we are a very important thing? All right, well, thank you very much.